So we're going to switch gears now and talk about ADHD. And the article in New York Times really raised a lot of issues. And there's been a lot of controversy over the years about what this disorder really is. Is it being overdiagnosed? Some people have argued that communities of color are adversely affected by this diagnosis. Other people are arguing, actually in some other articles I just read over the weekend, that the wealthy communities are actually overdiagnosed with ADHD. Whatever's happening, it's a $9 billion industry for the pharmaceutical industry, and who are really selling a lot of this to the consumers, to families, about protecting their children. Some people are worried that in the coming year that the official diagnosis of ADHD is going to be expanded, which will allow the inclusion of many more millions of children. And that's part of the controversy as well, the new DSM coming out. So we've gathered an interesting panel to kind of talk about what that means and how we diagnose it, what it says. Is it a real disorder? Is it not a real disorder? If it is, are we treating it correctly? What's at the root of this of the growth of either the disorder or the diagnosis of the disorder of young people being diagnosed with this disorder? We are joined by Dr. Adana Johnson-Evans, who is Assistant Professor of Psychology at Loyola University. Great to have you in the studio.
Thank you for having me.
More than that, you run the graduate program?
I don't run the graduate program. I supervise doctoral students
That's
at the Loyola Clinical
right.
Centers. I'm a child and adolescent therapy supervisor there, and I also teach cultural issues courses at the undergraduate and graduate level. And I'm also a private practice owner of Epaco Wellness Counseling, which is a holistic approach to therapy.
And joins us in studio. And Dr. Linda Spencer is with us. She's a speech-language pathologist who works with youth and the former professional advisor to and coordinator of CHAD, Children and Adults with Attention Deficit Hyperactive Disorder, the Maryland chapter. Good to have you in the, welcome to the studio.
Thanks so much.
Dr. Gabor Mate is with us. He's a physician and best-selling author. His book in America is titled, it was titled differently in Canada and overseas, Scattered, How Attention Deficit Disorder Originates and What You Can Do About It. And Dr. Gabor Mate, thank you for joining us as well.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Dr. Umar Johnson is with us, school psychologist in Pennsylvania, author of Psychoacademic Holocaust, The Special Education and ADHD Wards Against Black Boys. And Dr. Johnson, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you.
And all of you, join us here, 410-319-8888. This is a very serious issue, and it really a concern for many people. And let's just talk from all your perspectives. When we talk about attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, what are we talking about? Why do we think the growth and the diagnosis has grown so much in our world? Just what are we talking about? How do you think it is being defined in our world? Let me start with you, Dr. Spencer, and we'll move around the room.
Well, I was hoping you're going to defer to the...
Let me get you in the mic there.
I was hoping you're going to direct that question to the psychologist whose scope of practice permits diagnosis of ADHD. I'm professionally a speech-language pathologist, so at this point, could I yield the microphone to my colleague on the other side
of the
table?
But I think everybody can kind of wrestle with why this disorder is kind of growing so exponentially. But I don't know, if you want to jump in first, please do.
Sure. ADHD, or ADD, as many people say, it is a disorder. It's a persistent pattern of inattention and or hyperactivity and impulsivity. And in the most recent iteration of the DSM, which is the DSM-4-TR, the text revision, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder has a predominantly inattentive type and a predominantly hyperactive impulsive type. And then there's a combined type, but essentially symptoms of hyperactivity, inattention across many dimensions. And someone who meets the criteria has to have six components of each of those or either of those.
Sometimes I read about that disorder, I was thinking about you, Dr. Mate, because I feel like I could be in that, could be diagnosed with that myself, and in some ways have been as a young person.
I have been diagnosed with it.
So talk a bit about your perspective of what this disorder really means.
Well, I've been diagnosed with it personally, as have two of my children. The question is, what's happened to kids? Because in your country, in the United States, I'm Canadian, but in the United States, there are at least 3 million kids who are getting stimulant medications and another 500,000 who are getting antipsychotic medications. most of whom for ADHD. And we don't even know what the long-term effects of the antipsychotics will be on children. So it's a very serious issue. In my country, the number of stimulant prescriptions have gone up 43% in the last 5 years. Now, what I think is going on, actually, is has to do with the data that has come in the last 20 years or so on brain development. In other words, the brain development of the child occurs in an environment, and it's very much affected by the environment. So the circuits that have been mentioned, the symptoms of ADHD, the impulse regulation circuitry, the attention motivation regulation circuitry, the body self-regulation circuitry, which doesn't function well in people with ADHD, these need the right environment to develop properly. And the necessary environment, and because the human brain mostly develops under the impact of the environment, and the genes that activate human brain development are turned on and off by the environment. This is not controversial, it's just brain science. When the parental environment is stressed, the child's brain doesn't develop properly. And these circuits can be impaired neurophysiologically and neuroanatomically in their development. What I'm saying is going on is that the parenting environment in North America has become so stressed, not because parents don't love their kids, not because they don't have the best intentions, but simply because social, economic, and cultural stress has got to such a proportion, and the connections between parents and kids have been so impaired because of short maternity leaves in the States, because of stress on the parenting environment, because of the uncertainty, the loss of control that people have over their lives, that these stresses are particularly transmitted to particularly high-sensitive kids. And so what we're seeing is this epidemic that doesn't have to do with genetic inheritance, but it has to do with the stress in the parenting environment that, despite the parents' best efforts, is affecting the healthy development of children. And the solution, therefore, and I'll finish this part of my talk here, the solution there is not simply to hand out pills, and I'm not against medications. I've taken them myself, and they've helped me. But the solution has to be to address the environment in which kids are growing up and to understand what the behaviors actually represent. And unfortunately, for the most part, all we do is we hand out pills, and it's just not an adequate or even a good first line response to the ADHD epidemic.
Dr. Umar Johnson?
Yes, sir. I would add to the discussion that it's important to keep in mind that the diagnoses that we give to children, one, do not represent scientific facts, but rather professional opinions. There's an objective way to rule out or end the presence of any mental disorder, but it becomes even more interesting when you're talking about a disruptive behavior disorder, because instead of looking at emotions as pathology or cognitions as pathology, we're looking at behavior as pathology. And the ethical issue with the diagnosis of ADHD in children is that children are not a self-referring population. And what I mean to say by that is if an adult feels they have ADHD and they want the medication, that's acceptable because the adult is taking responsibility for being medicated. But when an 8, 9, 10, 11-year-old child or even a teenager is sent to the psychologist for a disruptive behavior disorder evaluation, then evaluated because they see something wrong with themselves. Most of the time, they're being evaluated because the parent or the teacher, and for African-American children, it's usually the teacher who's complaining about the behavior. So the diagnosis and medication is coming not from a child who feels like they're suffering from a mental illness, but from adults who feel like their lives are being inconvenienced. And as someone who works predominantly in the schools as a school psychologist and as a doctor of clinical psychology and as a child therapist, I can tell you that the teacher complaints are driving the ADHD rates, particularly for African-American and Hispanic boys, through the roof. When the child's parent is asked by the teacher to get them evaluated, the psychologist and psychiatrist almost always goes exclusively off of the opinions of the classroom teacher as expressed to the parent. And it is the complaints of the teacher rather than a thorough psychological evaluation that is ultimately determining who gets drugged or not. In fact, children are being evaluated within 5 minutes. I see this on a regular basis in Philadelphia, New York, New Jersey, all across the country. Children are literally getting evaluated psychologists and psychiatrists, and now we even have pediatricians who are not trained as experts in mental health but can legally write prescriptions. Now pediatricians who know almost nothing about mental illness are writing prescriptions for Ritalin, Adderall, Strattera, Cyclerk, Vyvanse, and these other medications, even without a diagnosis. And the last thing I want to say is that these criteria, as listed in the DSM for ADHD, the discriminant validity of ADHD is extremely poor. And by discriminant validity, we're looking at the extent to which the criteria of ADHD as written does not accidentally include children who are normal, does not accidentally include children who are dealing with adjustment issues, does not accidentally include children with other problems.
So
it's not that ADHD doesn't exist. It's that the way in which the criteria are written is so weak and so poor that any child, any given day of the year, can be diagnosed with it.
So if we look at... Can we deal with that feedback, please? If we deal with the kind of confluence, the preponderance of the diagnosis of ADHD, I mean, that has grown exponentially over the last 10 years, the last 20 years, a 41% rise in the last 10 years of diagnosis of ADHD in the society, in the United States. And so I'm curious why you think that is. I mean, we're looking now at the fifth edition of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, the DSM, that people in the field know about, and how we look at disorders. And they're putting all kinds of things in there that are very controversial in this new piece. But what they're doing with this, as I've been reading about this morning, is that is to kind of really broaden the definition, so that everything from children who are losing their cell phones and can't keep track of their paperwork and can't keep track of what's going on around them are now will be able to be diagnosed and also medicated. We're talking also about a $9 billion industry, as I said earlier, of medication. So I mean, what is going on? I don't mean in why has it grown exponentially over the last 10 years? What is at the bottom of that?
I think there's a couple of reasons. First of all, I think many more kids are indeed in trouble. I mean,
many more kids are indeed in trouble. Is that what you said?
They're exhibiting troubled and troubling behaviors.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because I think the parenting environment has become so stressed. That's the one point, and I insist on that because that's what's going on. And if we're going to help these kids, it's the environment we have to change, not the kids, in the schools and in the homes. Number one. Number two, it's certainly true that the pharmaceutical industry drives this terrifically, and it's also true that the physician, the psychiatrist most singly responsible for driving the broad diagnosis of ADHD, Dr. Joseph Biederman, whose research basically underlies so much of childhood mental health diagnosis, including bipolar illness and ADHD, took a $1.7 or $1.8 million from the drug companies, which he never declared in his research. So his papers actually were read as the Bible by so many physicians. So that I think there's two factors. Number one, we have many more troubled kids because of social and economic and cultural factors and stress on the parents. And number two, we have a pharmaceutical industry that knows how to exploit that situation, and physicians who comply with the pharmaceutical agenda. So I think it's and as was said earlier, the schools would rather medicate kids than deal with their emotional and psychological dynamics, because the schools are not prepared to deal with the real child. They just want to turn out well-behaved and kids who acquire information but don't have psychological and emotional problems. So we ignore the emotional and psychological needs of kids. We are driven by a pharmaceutical industry whose interest is to sell as many pills as possible. And we also have many more troubled kids because of the stress in North American society. All those factors are driving it, I think.
So let's just take that for a moment, what Dr. Monti just said. And again, let me turn back to Dr. Spencer. I mean, everybody else here, do people agree with that analysis of why there's been a growth? And if they do, then what's the response?
Well, 10 years ago, the Congressional Black Caucus went on record as voicing concern that ADHD actually was underidentified in African American children, and wondered why the incidence was so much lower than in Caucasian children. So that was 10 years ago. In 2010, the data put out by the CDC said that the diagnosis rate for boys was 10% in Caucasian boys and 11% in African American boys. That's not substantially different. In the last couple of years, there has been an uptick in diagnosis rates. I don't think it's exponential. I think it's quantitatively larger, and a lot of eyes are on those numbers because nobody knows what those numbers are. Some of the changes that are going on with the DSM, the ones that you report, that you referenced about losing cell phones and things like that, I think that that was broadened in order to validate concerns voiced by adults who believed that they had ADHD, had never been diagnosed as children, were very troubled by lifelong patterns of failure, and having learned about ADHD, became convinced that that was the cause of their difficulty. And indeed, in tracking back, it did look like that at one time in their childhood, they actually did meet the current diagnostic criteria, but because of where they lived and the times, they simply were never diagnosed. You know, the bar is a lot higher for success now than it was 50 years ago. When I was a kid, a lot of kids dropped out of school. They had ADHD, but academically there was no place for them. It's not that they were not there. They were. They simply went into the workforce. That doesn't happen today.
So you don't think the rate is actually increasing?
So what did you say, Dr. Omar?
Let me just do
one at a time because we can't. Everybody's trying to say something at once here. But Umar, you were trying to say something. Then we'll go over to Adela and Gabor. What were you trying to say?
Let me let Umar finish
what he was saying, and then we'll come back. Umar.
Yes. What I was going to say was that unknowns in this situation, particularly as it relates to African-American and Latino boys. For anyone who would argue that black boys are less diagnosed than white boys, does not work in the schools. There's classrooms around this country. There's even schoolhouses around this country where nearly every African-American or Latino boy is on some form of stimulant medication. And the one thing that has to be entered into this discussion is educational racism as well as psychiatric racism. For example, we know that children who receive Medicaid disproportionately end up on these medications and are often given higher dosages of the medication. And, of course, African-American boys and children in general are disproportionately represented within that population. So we have to look at the fact that in our public schools, recess has been cut, gym class has been cut, social activity has been cut. 93% of America's teachers are middle-class white women. There's almost no African-American male or Latino male teachers in this country, and no one's dealing with the interaction between the white female teacher and the black male student that is driving the ADHD rates out of control. And I would also argue that I have found in my evaluation that mental giftedness and also adjustment-related issues from the death of loved ones, bullying, low self-esteem, and depression to be a significant differential diagnosis for ADHD. So, yes, these children do have problems, but it's not ADHD, and you cannot solve the causes of their problems with drugs. Drugs don't solve problems. But because we don't want to take the time out to get to know these children and focus on the factors that's leading to their maladjustment, we simply want to give them a pill so they can be quiet and leave us alone.
So, unfortunately, I have to take a very brief break, and we'll come right back to our other two guests, because I wanted to hear what Dr. Boromonte wanted to say in response to Dr. Spencer and bring Dr. Adonna Johnson-Evans in with her thoughts as well, and really kind of explore if what we're saying here, if some of the new studies coming out, we'll talk about in a bit, that show that violence and maternal depression have an effect on the diagnosis of children with ADHD later. If it is environmental and social, then what are we looking at here in America if this continue exponential, if this is an exponential rise, and if that's the reason, if there is, and if there is an exponential rise? We'll be right back. Stay with us. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner as we explore ADHD. You can join us here at 410-319-8888, 410-319-8888. As the calls are coming in, if I get their names, I'll get them on the air. We have with us here Dr. Linda Spencer, speech-language pathologist who works with youth, former professional advisor and coordinator of CHAD, Children and Adults with Attention Deficit Hyperactive Disorder in Maryland. Dr. Gabor Mate, physician and best-selling author of the book Scattered, How Attention Deficit Disorder Originates and What You Can Do About It. Dr. Umar Johnson, a school psychologist from Pennsylvania and author of the book Psychoacademic Holocaust, the Special Education and ADHD Wars Against Black Boys. And Dr. Adana Johnson-Evans, who is assistant professor, assistant professor at Loyola University, Maryland, in the Department of Psychology, a licensed psychologist and owner of Epoco Wellness Counseling, and supervises doctoral clinical psychology trainees in a child and adolescent therapy at the Loyola University Clinical Centers. 410-319-8888 is the number here. We'll come right to your calls, but I want to let our guests come back. Adana, you wanted to say something, and then I'll go back to Gabor.
Yeah, I think Dr. Mate and Dr. Johnson both raised some interesting points as it relates to issues of environment and then bias. One of the things that is present in the literature regarding access to health care, particularly mental health care, for people of color and especially people of African descent, is that folks don't necessarily have access to resources that their white counterparts have. And if they do find themselves having access to mental health resources, oftentimes clinicians, psychologists, mental health practitioners at the master's level are not well prepared to consider not just the diagnostic criteria, but to also consider the contextual factors, thinking about environment, thinking about issues of psychological health as it relates to experiences of poverty, violence, etc. And so I think one of the problems that is a piece of this enormous jigsaw puzzle that is ADHD, one of the problems is clinicians are diagnosing not necessarily based on the diagnostic criteria, which in and of itself is troubling, granted, but clinicians are not diagnosing children always based on what they see. They're sometimes inhibited by their biases about people of African descent or people of color. And so I think that they are sometimes diagnosing fear. They're taking data from one environment, which the diagnostic criteria says that it needs to, the behavior needs to be present in two environments. They're taking evaluations from teachers. We have report measures to teachers all the time. It's very common in psychology. And they bring these reports back, and the teacher's saying, oh, the child's out of his seat. He's constantly not paying attention, etc. And then we're using that one piece of data as a profession to diagnose children with ADHD. Now, that is problematic. That is against what we are supposed to be doing as a profession, even setting aside our problems with the criteria. And so part of what I think needs to happen is there needs to be a shift in training psychologists, training mental health practitioners to not walk in and accept one piece of data or to lead with what they would expect based on statistics and truly take the time to create evaluations. But, you know, there are other ecological problems that influence how we approach diagnosis, timing, expectations from insurance companies, and whether or not we're even going to get paid. So if you take the 5 hours that it takes to conduct a thorough psychological evaluation and the child does not meet the criteria, and you perhaps consider, well, if I submit this for Medicare or Medicaid, if I submit this to an insurance company and I don't have this diagnosis, I won't get paid for the 5 hours of work that I've done, there becomes an ethical question. And people sometimes make the wrong decision and provide a diagnosis in order to make sure that their time is compensated for, and then perhaps planting a label on a child that is carried with them for time to come.
So, Gabor Mate, you had a response that you wanted to give before we open the phones here. We have some more other questions.
Well, I'll put it in the form of a question, specifically to Umar Johnson. I appreciate what you're saying about the situation of black American kids, but it's also true, for example, that black American males have a significantly higher risk of dying of prostate cancer than Caucasians do. And that's not a racist statement, that's just the reality. And I think it's because of racism. I think it's because of stress on American males. I think that cancer has a lot to do with stress. I think everything does. Now, in similarly, I don't think you'll disagree with me, and I'm not an American, and I'm certainly not black, so I'm asking in the form of a question, respectfully. It's also certainly true that the black American family, because of historical racism and economic oppression and marginalization, everything that you know about much more than I do, has been under much greater pressure than, say, the average Caucasian family, historically. And under those conditions of stressed families and single mother families, those kids are extraordinarily stressed. And that's going to show up somehow in their behaviors. Now, I agree with you totally that the behaviors are not the problem. The behaviors are simply a sign of a problem. And it's the underlying dynamics, psychological and social dynamics that we have to address in helping these kids. But it's certainly useful from my perspective to at least to identify the kids who are at risk, who are actually in trouble. And it's interesting to me that as far as I can tell from recent statistics, the population group or the ethnic group least likely to be diagnosed with ADHD in the United States is the Hispanic group. And it's precisely in the Hispanic population that family ties and extended family ties and community ties are still the strongest. And I think that this diagnosis has a lot to do with the breaking of family ties, with the destruction of families, with the stress on families in any ethnic group, and that it would seem natural to me that the people most under social and economic and racial stress, and regardless of color, but they'd be the ones who would be the most at risk for childhood behavior manifestations of underlying difficulties. And so I'm just putting it to you whether I may agree with you that the diagnosis is overdone and people are way too quick to hand out pills. But at the same time, are we not seeing a lot of troubled behaviors in families who are under all these stresses?
Umar Johnson, you want to respond?
Yes, I would like to respond. Number one, he brought up prostate cancer. Prostate cancer, the reason black men suffer more mortality from prostate cancer isn't because of race. It's because of poor diet, poor health care, poor economic circumstances that dictate a poor diet, and then racism that dictates poor health care.
That's my
point.
It's
not because they're black that they have more prostate cancer.
That's what
I think you both agree on that. But
it's not because of that they're black that they suffer more morbidity from prostate cancer. It's because of the poor health care.
But that's my point.
So once again, you're looking at the interaction of racism. The other thing that I also wanted to be clear about, and this is mirrored in the educational and psychological research, and that is that African-American learners, especially boys, okay, are disproportionately expelled and suspended from school, disproportionately placed in special education, disproportionately diagnosed with disruptive behavior disorders, not just ADHD, but also conduct disorder and disruptive behavior disorder and emotional disturbance, which is almost exclusively a black male phenomenon, more than anyone else, including the Hispanics. So if the argument is that this situation is only due to the fact that they're poor and thus the families have less resources, I disagree with that. It's not just the socioeconomic constraints, but you also have to account for the role of racism. That is intentional bias and discrimination against African-American children, and particularly their boys, that supersedes class and cannot simply be explained by economics alone.
Well, I don't think that what Dr. Monte was saying earlier was contradiction. That I think that actually plays into what you both were saying.
Mm-hmm.
I want to open the phones here, but I do have a question that I need to come back to that kind of combines everything you all said to see what kind of perfect storm we're facing in America for the future and with this diagnosis. But let's go first to Carla. Carla, you're on the air at 410-319-8888.
Good evening. How are you?
Very well. Welcome.
Very interesting conversation. And I just wanted to ask a couple of questions. One is, how much does the the lack of physical and right brain activity, like physical activity, as well as music and, you know, all of those things, the arts that are taken out of the schools is playing into this additional stress that's being visited upon the children, you know, not only in the schools but also in the communities as well, that shows up as this type of behavior. And the other question is in terms of, you know, the lack of or the underrepresentation of, you know, developing a person's spiritual and moral character is also playing up because of the fact that families are under stress because of economics or because of having to work long hours in order to maintain a certain lifestyle and those types of things that shows up in the children, as well as the amount of violence that's taking place in the community and in the schools that the children carry with them. And I will take your responses off air. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Let's first with what Carla said, because that's basically where I was going with this next question. I mean, if in fact the studies that show that violence and social dislocation and familial dislocation could be at the root of the growth of ADHD, and as Dr. Mati talks about the stolen childhood of people, that childhood is gone the way, in terms of its interaction with adults, and that if because of both class and racism in America, that kind of dislocation disproportionately affects communities of color in this country, though it affects all communities, but much more intensely in communities of color. That and then we have this $9 billion industry that is feeding in the medication that is actually being sold in many ways by advertising directly to families, saying we can help your children be whole. They should be taking this medication. That if you have all that and the kind of new testing regimen we were talking about during the break in our schools, is this not in some ways a perfect storm that's going to cause an explosion in ADHD and ADHD diagnosis?
Well, Dr. Bessel van der Kolk, who's an international expert on trauma and a professor of psychiatry at Boston University, has written about what he calls developmental trauma. And he points out that many children, many children in American society are traumatized regularly. And these children show up with symptoms of hyperactivity, with inattention, with poor impulse control, oppositionality, and all that kind of stuff. And so that's certainly the social conditions that disrupt children's lives have a lot to do with the symptoms that they act out. Our problem is that we make these into medical problems when actually they're social and psychological problems. That's the first point. As to the caller who talked about the play and hyperactivity, there was a study out of Notre Dame University that looked at what is the optimal parenting environment. They found it to be the hunter-gatherer tribe. Because in the hunter-gatherer tribe, kids are with the parents the whole time. Kids are relating to multiple generations of parents, not just a single parent or not just an isolated nuclear parent family in a bungalow somewhere. And kids get lots of time to act for active play. And in many American schools, play has been discouraged as it interferes with what they think is academic progress. But physical activity and play and artistic creativity and artistic expression, all these natural childhood attributes are essential for healthy development. When we, in Atlanta, Georgia, at some point, they actually stopped building playgrounds in the schools because the supervisor said that kids don't learn anything hanging from monkey bars. Well, the fact is, they do learn stuff hanging from monkey bars. They need that physical activity. So in forcing kids into totally unnatural situations, we invited them to be hyperactive.
And on all that together, what you're just saying, I think, and I want to add that level again, that you were speaking about, Umar Johnson, that if these studies are true, and if oppression, the oppression of poverty and racism is also trauma, then that adds to the explosion of children with hyperactivity who, rather than being cared for and changed, are diagnosed and medicated.
Well, I think an important point is that, and this, I think, kind of extends what Dr. Umar Johnson was saying, that children, particularly African-American children, as this keeps kind of coming up in our conversation today, African-American boys are not walking into school in kindergarten and first grade displaying these behaviors in disproportionate numbers in comparison to their white counterparts. School in of itself is a traumatic experience based on the lack of resources, based on the expectations that they will fail, based on teachers who are from environments that still children cannot relate to, and that they've never, their first interaction with an African-American person is after 4 years of college, getting a degree in education or some other related field, coming into a classroom and having to interact with a child from a cultural background that you know nothing about. And so children are being traumatized. Their expectations of children are low. And something happens to black boys in school systems. Dr. Jawanza Kunjufu has written about the fourth grade syndrome, that boys are expected to fail, that they're looked upon poorly. Teachers ignore them. They pathologize them. They don't want them in their classrooms. They're getting suspended and expelled at exponential rates, particularly in the state of Maryland. The average child to be diagnosed with ADHD is 13. He's more likely to be male. He's disproportionately African-American. He's been suspended and expelled multiple times. And what's interesting is his academic ability and cognitive ability are not the same. So while they may be flunking out of school, cognitively they are functioning at an average level or higher. So what is this truly about? You know, I think it really calls that question to the table. How are we convoluting what may be expectations and socialization and environmental factors and bias on behalf of their teachers and clinicians who are diagnosing them in the schools and in the community? Or is it this piece of stress alone? I don't think it's just the stress alone. I think it's a combination thereof.
Well, this goes back to your comment about what happens when you spend 5 hours evaluating a child. What happens when I spend 4 to 5 hours evaluating a child? I see ADHD children professionally because they're more likely to have problems with language processing. It takes that long to get to know the child, to get to know the family, to review all the background information, to do the formal testing, before you're even ready to sit down and see what the numbers look like. It takes that long to figure out how many factors may be impacting a particular child, and you can't do that in 5 minutes.
But unfortunately, that's what's happening.
Exactly.
And by people who aren't necessarily qualified to do so, like pediatricians who aren't as well-versed as psychologists and psychiatrists in psychological issues.
What we know about kids with ADHD is that they are more likely to have other things going on in their lives. They're more likely to have other co-occurring conditions. We need to know what they are. The answer is not to say, let's make all this go away. I think the answer is, let's put more trained eyes on it. And let's make a concerted effort to spend the time that really is required in order to know what is making a particular child tick. Why is this child in a situation where things are not working out appropriately? I was mentioning to you what we talk about among our CHAD people, which is, how do you create an ADHD-friendly classroom? Well, an ADHD-friendly classroom doesn't require that everybody sit stock still with their little hands folded on a desk. When I test kids and I see that they're getting a little edgy, I suggest that they stand up and walk around. And I ask them for feedback. Do you find that that is helpful to you? Or can I give you something to hold in your hand to manipulate? Does that help you? Do you do that in school, and do you think that helps you in school if you're working with something with your hands, or if you actually can get out of your seat, go someplace, do something, and come back to your seat? And those are very realistic and doable things that can be done to change the world of a child who may have ADHD but may be able to perform better in a school environment if we separate the behavior from the academics.
But in marginally in marginalized communities where there is not even enough books to go around in the classroom, that I've been in classrooms as a school counselor prior to finishing my PhD. I've been in classrooms where there were 25 desks squeezed together, back to back, literally. Mm-hmm. And there is no room to stand up. And even if there is room, even if there is room, there is no tolerance for what the child needs and what the environment, the realities of the environment are unfortunately drastically different. And I think for people of color, that's even more so the case. So if we do have children who perhaps need more space to move around, which I think is almost every child, depending on their developmental stage and what's happening for them in their environments, whether it's divorce, whether it's poverty, mm-hmm. et cetera, could use that space to stand up, to move around.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that, you know, what you're presenting, these ideas of being able to have manipulatives, being able to stand up and walk around a classroom, there are teachers who would laugh at that and say that's not even a possibility because we're just trying to get through to teach the core curriculum and make sure that they still have a job because they need all of their children to pass a test. Mm-hmm. And so when there's a child who's not cooperating with that process or is disrupting that process, let's send them out of the room.
Mm-hmm. All I can say is what one particular child needs.
Except that we have to talk about an entire system here, I think.
That's right.
Well, you can't divorce
the system from the expectations.
Every system is composed of individual children. I see them one at a time. I know what the system looks like. I know what the classroom looks like. I can only present what that child needs.
But
and I think that that is a very healthy perspective. I do think that we have to be sure that children receive their individuality. But I think what the previous speaker was trying to draw out was the fact when we talk about changing social policy and changing educational policy and changing psychological policy, that can't be done for individuals. That is done for groups. And because it is done for groups, we got to look at how the current practices are disproportionately affecting certain groups so that when the policy is changed, it can bring about a change of conditions for most of those children. So although in our individual work, we want to deal with that individual children as they are, separate from all other students and learners, and that is the way we should continue to practice, on the political level, we have to deal with changing the condition for groups because social policy is done for the masses, not for individuals.
So let me, Governor Mate, bring you back in for a moment. So it's tying this together for a bit for all four of you. What should be our next conversation? What should be our response to growing ADHD? What should be the response if it's not medication? Let me go very quickly. We have like 5 minutes left. I want to get Gabor's quick thoughts, and then we'll come back to yours and go around the room. Gabor.
Well, the first conversation should be how to prevent it, and that means a lot more support for families. The idea that in the average maternity leave in the States is 6 weeks is barbaric. Maternity leave should be at least a year so that mothers can be with their kids and give them that attuned attention that children need for their development. Secondly, when kids are diagnosed, they should be seen not as an individual pathology of the child, but as essentially a cry for help from the child to the environment to make their environment more suitable for his or her healthy development. And that means lots of adult attachment, lots of support, lots of room for the child's individuality. And the schools need to be far more flexible in their approach to these kids. Number three, the child's brain can develop in healthy ways even later on in life as long as the conditions are right, so they need lots of warm attention and contact and attachment from all the caregivers. The schools should not be just knowledge factories. They should be places of emotional support, attachment, and creativity. And number four is still necessary in a far number, lesser number of cases. It might be appropriate to use medications. I've used them myself. I've prescribed them. I'm not against them. But we overuse them mercilessly, and we don't do anything for the child's development. And as somebody else, I think Umar said in his talk, the pills don't fix anything. They simply control symptoms, but they don't change the underlying problem.
And Umar, we have about 3 minutes left. I want to get everybody's last thoughts in here. Umar?
Yes, sir. I would say number one, parental education is number one, because these children don't get evaluated in the first place unless the parent gives consent. They don't get medicated until the parent brings the child to the psychiatrist. So we have to educate and empower the parents in terms of the role that they have in being able to reduce a lot of these problems without necessarily going to the psychologist or the psychiatrist. I know in my book, Psychoacademic Holocaust, I have a whole chapter dealing with behavior modification, how you can change hyperactivity and inattention without spanking a child and without drugs. We need to go back to some traditional forms of behavioral modification. And the other thing, which was mentioned by some of the other guests on the show, and that is there needs to be more public outcry about how the law has not been trying to make psychologists and psychiatrists publicly responsible as it relates to the money that they receive from the psychiatric drug companies. And also, there needs to be public outcry in terms of making sure that people are aware when the psychiatric drug companies pay for the research that says their drug is necessary and that the drugs are beneficial. Much of the research out there supporting these medications are paid for by the psychiatric drug cartel.
So, Dr. Johnson, let me just very quickly, we literally have a minute left. I thought we had a bit more time than that, and I want Dr. Johnson Evans a quick thought and a quick thought from Dr. Spencer.
Yeah, I agree with the piece about educating families. I think it's very important to talk about what pragmatically people can do to advocate for themselves and for their children. So one of the things that I focus on in training students is educating them on what they should do in terms of advocating for their clients and teaching their clients how to advocate for themselves in schools, leading them to have access to resources that will allow them to do that. I think it's also important for psychologists when families bring in children to my practice and they say that their child has been diagnosed with ADHD, to not accept that diagnosis as gold, but to then do my own evaluation and to talk with parents about how this diagnosis fits for them and to ask them to question that process.
About 30 seconds after Dr. Spencer.
And we know that medication doesn't teach skills. And one of the main problems that kids with ADHD have is difficulty in the area of what we call executive functioning. Chad's been working with a local school system, Howard County Public Schools, to put together a program to train executive functioning in children. And we think that this is going to be very, very helpful.
Well, we can put all of our guest information about their work and what they do, so you can see more of what they're saying about ADHD. You just heard Dr. Linda Spencer, speech pathologist who works with youth, Dr. Adina Johnson Evans, assistant professor of psychology at Loyola University, who's with us, Dr. Gabor Mate, physician and author of the book Scattered, How Attention Deficit Disorder Originates and What You Can Do About It, psychologist Dr. Umar Johnson, whose book is Psychoacademic Holocaust, the Special Education ADHD Wars Against Black Boys. Thank the four of you so much. It's been a very enlightening and powerful discussion.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Okay, take care.
Thank you. We'll remind you as well, on the way to our next segment, the Mark Steiner Show is sponsored in part by the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development. Mortgage late? Don't wait. If you're struggling with your mortgage and the state of Maryland is offering housing counseling and legal assistance, Maryland's HOPE program can even help you understand the state's mediation law and the Attorney General's National Foreclosure Settlement. Don't wait. Get help today. More information at mdhope.org or at 877-462-7555. We'll be right back.